Sima Shapiro, the host of the new contemporary lifestyle radio show for women over 40, featuring everything about your health, wealth, children, happiness, and anything else of interest to you, the listener. Please stay tuned. Welcome. Today I'll be talking with an activist and mom of adoptive children and a lawyer involved in child custody and mental health cases about the many complex aspects of adoptive foster children and the lack of adequate medical health services for those kids out and in of the state's family services system. Maureen O'Neill Davis is a married mom with three children. She is a member and volunteer legislative advocate for the Attachment and Trauma Network and a member of the Connecticut Children's Behavioral Health Advisory Committee and the Behavioral Health Partnership Oversight Council. She leads a grassroots family forward advocacy effort to change state policies and practices around access to treatment for traumatized kids. Attorney Connie Reguli has practiced family law throughout Middle Tennessee for over 20 years. She has served as a prosecutor in Nashville, Tennessee as well. She has the largest verdict in the state of Tennessee awarded to children against their parents for the abuse they suffered in childhood. She is an adoptive parent of three children. So welcome, Maureen and Connie.
Well, hello, Sima, and thank you for having us today.
I'm excited.
Thank you so much.
I'm really excited. I think this is a fundamentally important topic to be addressing at this time. So, Connie, tell me a little bit about your journey and your passion for this work.
Well, you know, it's interesting you have a show for women over 40. I think my whole life started at 40. I went back to college in my late 30s and got a law degree, so I did not get out of law school until I was 42 years old, and then I adopted at 44. So I, you know, just sort of began this journey of working through the family law system, and I became so interested in what I saw happening with families within the court system, and particularly either children that were abused or parents who were being wrongfully accused. So, you know, many of these cases that I would take a look at, I mean, other attorneys had cast by the wayside, just like the case where I represented the four children who had been abused by their parents, and ultimately we got a jury verdict. So I just think by nature I'm an encourager and I'm an advocate, and so I found my way through this system working for families in this area.
And Maureen?
Well, I started out in my 30s getting married for the first time, adopted a few children, and along that pathway, my husband's sister was killed via domestic violence, and we adopted her daughters. One of her daughters suffered quite a bit as a result of the trauma, and in our journey to get her the treatment and care that she really needed to address her conditions, we found ourselves subject to Child Protective Services practices in a way that we weren't expecting. And we realized that the child protective system was not designed or equipped to respond to families being directed to it to access higher levels of care. And through that journey, I have found my way into advocacy because I felt no family should have to go through what we went through to attempt to get our daughter the care that she needed.
So what has your experience taught you about the lack of services for those families who don't utilize state services and funding or who use privatized care?
Well, one of the things that I found is having private insurance does not necessarily give you access to the higher levels of care that providers direct you to. And having state insurance or Medicaid equally does not give you access to the higher levels of care that providers will direct you to. In both circumstances, families are directed to a child welfare system in many states to access these higher levels of care. In doing so, most states filter these families into child protection, meaning the way the department then views you, processes you as a parent, views the child as having a safety risk, takes you down a road to being accused or shamed and blamed into their process. Your child who needs certain types, specific types of care, is denied access to that care because it's very expensive. And as a parent, you really lose the opportunity to advocate on your child's behalf because through that system, you are viewed as the problem in the child's life. It has been a very difficult road. And what I found was The more you know about your child's conditions, the more you research and try to gain access to certain types of care that provide you with hope and seem promising, the harder the system comes at you for working those paths and trying to come up with the funding to get your child access to that care.
Mm-hmm.
If I might be able to add to that, if you don't mind,
sure.
I mean, Maureen has really worked this from the parent side, and she has really gathered around her many parent advocates who've also had similar experiences. But let me tell you, just so the listeners are not confused about this, as an attorney, I have seen the very same thing while trying to advocate for parents and children. I have stood in courtrooms and heard the judge say, well, if we just put the child in state's custody, we can get more services. And so when they do that, they have to find a way to put the child into state's custody per the court record. And that is generally making statements that the parents are the problem, which is exactly what Maureen is talking about.
So I know that both of you are serving as activists and pushing federal and state regulations to change, also trying to pass some acts. The Family First Prevention Services Act is one of the latest journeys you're both taking. Tell me a little bit about the need for that type of legislation, and do you foresee it being on a state level or on a federal level? Connie?
Sure, and thanks for asking that question. And your listener should have just sort of a broad sweeping overview of what the legislative impact has been on the child welfare programs. We are basically going through a 50-year program, a social experiment, I call it, of trying for the government to be the parent of the child. And it started in 1974 when the Child CAPTA, the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, was passed by Congress and was promoted by Mondale. And even in the legislative history, there are remarks in there that we must be careful because this could turn around and end up giving the wrong incentives to the states. And since then, there has been layer upon layer upon layer of federal legislation that is all geared around developing funding programs for the states. And it comes in two categories. It comes in the category of funding for the states that is for foster care and adoption. That's one category. And the second category is for family rehabilitation, reunification, family and social services. Those are two distinct categories of federal funding. The Title IV-E funding, which is the foster care money, is unlimited, and it is currently 10 times the amount of money that is given to the states for family services. And so now, without going through each one of those layers of legislations today, because we certainly wouldn't have time to do that, what is the most current bill before the Congress is the Families First and Prevention Act, and it is intended to redirect that funding. And this is such an important part of the whole system because every single state in this country is totally dependent upon that money to operate their state agencies. Half of their state budget is that federal funding.
So you're in Connecticut, correct, Maureen?
Yes, I am.
And if so, talk to me about why you're making some amount of headway in this state and what other states are following suit, or are you having any luck in any other states?
Well, several states have taken a look at the federal legislation and see that it is proposing to redirect funding. Some states are considering that as a new objective and are working at the state level to respond to that new federal objective ahead of time. We're hoping that the Family First Prevention Services Act, which is scheduled to come to the Senate floor this month during the lame duck session, will pass and will be signed into law. Its premise of redirecting funding to states based on a more kinship connection and family integrity model will not take effect for 2 years. So even if it passes, we still have two more years at the state level to work on reforming policies and our own practices to move how we serve families through child protection agencies to a more family integrity and child mental health response model, which is really about reunification and preservation of the family. We are making headway in the state of Connecticut. We do have a large group of advocates working to bring legislation at the state level around these issues this session. And we're focusing right now on child mental health care and working with families through child protection reform to meet the needs of children with mental health issues earlier in their journey to get help by way of redirecting these federal funds for that purpose.
Connie, why hasn't this been unilaterally passed on a federal level? And what makes some of the differences between some of the states' reactions to either allowing this type of groundswell to continue or trying to squash it?
Title IV-E funds are unlimited, and they are under a use-it-or-lose-it funding scheme. So that means that the states must use all the money that they used the prior year, or they will lose that funding in the coming year. And if you look at every single state agency budget, you will see that those federal funds are anywhere from about 38% to about 48% of their entire budget for that agency. And so as these senators and congressmen look at it, there is some throwback as to how is that going to affect the state's budget related to the child welfare agency. For instance, one of the states that's a holdout is Texas. And in a conversation, when we had an advocate in Washington going door-to-door to the senators to try to make sure that it was going to pass, one of the holds out is a Texas senator. And when she asked him about why he wasn't willing to go ahead and sign it, he said he had passed it off to the governor of the state to take a look at. So there's only one reason that it would affect the governor, and that's because of the state budget. The child welfare agencies are, and this is a very important thing for people to understand as well, the whole child welfare system has become an industry. It is a privatized industry. This is another social experiment that we've been working on for 40 years. We privatized prisons, you know, we privatized several other services, but we also privatized foster care and some of the family services and social services going through these state agencies. The investors and the money and the lobbyists that are involved in this is just, it's tremendous. As a matter of fact, Senator Wyden was one of the senators who promoted and got this bill out before the House of Representatives to even take a look at, and he's in the Senate Finance Committee. Well, one of the largest foster care companies in the United States went and solicited Wyden's executive assistant to actually lobby against the bill, knowing that he would know the ins and outs of it and have the contacts within the system that had already been contacted. So it's become such a huge industry that any change in the funding scheme is going to affect the pockets of many private companies.
So before we break, I'm wondering why, Maureen, does the discussion of mental health services often get commingled with custody issues and the need for protective custody? They just don't seem to be in the same wheelhouse.
Well, they're not in the same wheelhouse in the sense that child protection agencies, child protective services, was never designed nor are they equipped to effectively respond to healthy families raising sick children. However, due to the funding mechanisms that are available to states, especially now that many states have budgets that have been affected by the Depression, Connecticut being one of the worst affected. In fact, we're number 50 in terms of job creation in response to the recession. State budgets are in need of some padding. So when you're looking at where states are going to draw federal funding from in the most plentiful way, Child Protective Services funding through Title IV-E is one of those mechanisms. Some states also put the burden of recognizing and responding to early child mental health needs on school districts. Connecticut is one of four states that puts the full responsibility of early identification and early treatment by way of special education accommodations on the school systems. When that is the practice, those school districts that have limited financial resources tend to overlook those kids that are being identified with early issues and pass it off as something else. Therefore, those needs are not responded to, they're not screened, they're not diagnosed. If they're diagnosed too early, the school district will be bearing the financial burden to help that family and respond to that child's needs for many, many years. So it's really several mechanisms that drive the child mental health delivery system model towards a child protection system to respond to.
We're going to take a short break, but I do want to ask you when we come back, why does this involve adopted and foster children, and what are some of the more commonly known disorders that fall under the range of this? We'll be right back. Thank you. Back now talking with two women about their work in advocacy in helping complex aspects of adoptive foster children and the lack of adequate mental services for those kids in and out of the state service systems. Number one, why does this involve mostly adopted and foster children, Maureen? And what happens if a child is struggling with not so common maladies such as reactive attachment disorder, trauma, dysregulation?
Thank you for asking that question. The entire action of losing one's parents is traumatizing to a child. This happens by way of the foster care system. It also happens by way of international adoptions. Many children adopted from outside the United States spend much of their early years in institutional settings like orphanages that make it very difficult for their basic needs to be fully met. Not having one's basic needs met as an infant and toddler, as well as losing the connection to a biological parent, either through adoption or through the removal of a child, is highly traumatizing. And that early childhood trauma leads many, not all, but many foster and adopted children to suffer from complex trauma-rooted conditions. One of the most severe conditions is referred to as reactive attachment disorder. It is a disorder that has different emotional deregulation features, psychological features, brain development features that often make the child difficult in terms of their behaviors, makes it difficult for them to give and receive love. Some of the symptoms of reactive attachment disorder is a propensity towards lying and stealing, triangulating between trusted adults, being afraid of the adults in their life that they should trust. They see those adults as individuals they should not trust and that they want to run away from. It's really a perceptual thing, but it's also a brain development event where the way the brain develops during those early trauma years, they see things really the opposite as the way they should in their environment. Child protection is so intertwined in the foster care system, of course, that is one of the reasons these cases kind of go hand in hand.
I'm struck by the more recent media examples of a mother who put her child back on the airplane to send him, I think it was, back to Russia. There have been a few cases of parents murdering their children, and I think this is such a complex issue and it has so many layers. All that the public ends up seeing is the sensationalism of it all. Would you agree, Connie?
Well, that is true, and one of those cases was right here out of Tennessee, and you know, I also have children that I adopted from Russia, and they were all 5 years old, so they were not babies, so they had a history behind them before they came to me. And each one of them handled the transition very, very differently. I mean, I went into it, I was already 44 years old, and I'd already studied psychology. I had my master's work in psychology behind me. I'd already gone through law school. So perhaps I was in a little bit more of a sophisticated place mentally in keeping my eye open for it. I also engaged a counselor with our family immediately when the children came here and started addressing these issues right away. And I don't know, I don't have their history. I don't know how much trauma each one of them suffered. But certainly, I saw that there were trauma issues and abandonment issues with each one of them. And then we segue that, and again, we talk about my passion for what I'm doing with child welfare. I mean, I see the child welfare agencies go into homes and take children away from their parents at any age. I mean, they're walking into hospitals and taking two-day-old babies, and they're taking children who are 5, 6, 7, 8 years old from their parents, and these parents don't know what to do. And a large percentage of these children that are removed under the category of neglect and not for abuse. And the listeners need to know that there are 400,000 children in the foster care system in the United States. And when you take that group of children and you say, well, each of those children has two parents and they have grandparents and they have siblings and they have cousins, there are millions and millions of people who are getting caught in this system. And we are re-engineering family ties, and we're taking things away from these children that they have a constitutional right to. The 14th Amendment of our United States Constitution gives us the right to parent, but it's more than that. It is a familial right. These children have a right to parents. They have a right to know their genealogy. They have a right to belong to the people that are their true family.
Connie, what are some of the challenges that you and your clients face, other than public sentiment perhaps being against you at points? What are some of the other catch-alls for your having some success in this area?
Well, you know, we have a very large Facebook presence. We have an open group, the Family Forward Project, and we're always posting on there things that are going on all over the United States. And through that, people identify me. They find out from other people on the internet my information. I literally get 3 or 4 or 5 people a day contact me through private message and telling me what has happened. Their children were removed 400 days ago, 300 days ago, 200 days ago. And here's what happens is they get caught in the system and always cycle back to the fact that the state gets their funding based upon the number of children in foster care. So the state has to maintain a certain level of children in foster care to have consistent funding. And this is not just conjecture on my part. You can go to a website called kidscount.org. And kidscount.org is a website and an organization that is created by the Casey Foundation. And they do statistics of children all over the United States. And you can find your state and you can scroll down through the statistics and you can do a 5-year history of the children entering and leaving foster care. And you're going to find that within 10%, it's the same number every year. And so the state is in control, and everybody is afraid of the state. The attorneys who are appointed by the courts are afraid of the state. The guardian ad litems are afraid of the state. Even the judges are afraid of the state, because the state agency has more control over the case than the judge does.
But I have to say, you were referencing yourself and having been in midlife when you first took on this journey as a mother. The proliferation of midlife mothering and new older parenting has produced a host of services popping up as a result of getting these kids or adopting these kids. Many of these people are very well intentioned, but really have no idea what they're getting into. Would you agree, Maureen?
Well, I don't fully agree with that statement. A lot of the families that have reached out to me in regards to the custody for care legislative agenda we're working on in the state of Connecticut, have reached out saying that they were educated. They did have information on some of the trauma features that were expected in their adopted children, or they were aware of the mental health issues that were organic within their lineage, and they went into parenting their kids with knowledge and competence. The problem seems to be when these very knowledgeable, competent parents reach out to a system that is ill-equipped to respond to their needs and their level of understanding of their own child's needs. That seems to be more of the issue I'm seeing in the families that reach out. It's very difficult for an agency, which is child protection, basically policing of parents, to help families and view families as partners in meeting their child's needs when the culture of that agency is to judge the parent and suspect the parent of wrongdoing at the very onset of involvement with that agency. I think that's one of the bigger problems. But on the adoption front, many, many adoption agencies, both domestic and international, fail to provide prospective parents with a full array of information on the conditions these kids may develop over the age of 5. The trauma features are one thing in the early years. They're a little easier to manage and maintain. But over the age of 5 or 6, those conditions tend to have symptoms that explode, can become very violent and unsafe in a home setting. And it is the child protection model of response then that comes in and responds, looks at this and says, this child doesn't want to be in this home. There must be something wrong with the home. Let's remove the child. And so that's where you get a child protection response that is ill-equipped to respond to traumatized children with competent parents.
Connie, we have very few seconds. What would you like to leave the listener with today?
Well, I would like for them to know that this is developing, and this is an emerging social issue that people are becoming more and more aware of and want to do something, and we have to do something. So Maureen and I are in the process of creating the Family Forward Foundation as a nonprofit group, and we're at that point where we're doing our developmental aspects of it, and we certainly hope that you will invite us back.
We've been talking with an activist and mom of adoptive children and a lawyer dealing with these same issues about the proposed passing of the Family First Prevention Services Act and the need for this type of legislation. Maureen O'Neill Davis can be found at Family Forward Project or ATN. Attorney Connie Raguli can be found at TENNFamilyLaw.com. Thank you so much, Maureen and Connie, for being my guest today. I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40. To the listener, thanks so much for joining us today. And until next time, I hope you take care.